Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Nobody has more respect for women than I do. Nobody.
Hillary Clinton wants to abolish it. Believe me. She wants to abolish our Second Amendment.
I think they didn't deny it. I don't think anybody denied it.
Other presidents did not call. They'd write letters, and some presidents didn't do anything.
Many people have come out and said, I'm right.
You really do have to ask yourself, where does it stop?
Hello and welcome to Fallacious Trump, the podcast where we use the insane ramblings of Fat Nixon to explain logical fallacies. I'm your host, Jim.
And I'm your other host, Mark. A logical fallacy is an error in reasoning that results in bad or invalid arguments. And the logical fallacy we're looking at this Christmas week is the argument from authority.
Yeah, so this would probably more accurately be called the argument from improper or false authority. Because it's okay to invoke authority if that authority is actually a genuine expert, an authority in the particular area that you're talking about.
Yeah.
So the fallacy here is where people invoke authorities that are either objectively not reliable or trustworthy, or they are authorities but not necessarily at the subject you're talking about. So a really common version of this is the appeal to celebrity, which is why Smartwater gets Jennifer Aniston to tell us that she uses it, and that means that we think that if she uses it, we should drink it. And if you know, Kendall Jenner is on the Pepsi adverts, and even if she did drink it, that doesn't necessarily make it a better soft drink for us.
Yeah.
So,
but there's also the implication that we would end up like
somehow,
her.
Yeah, somehow rub off some of that celebrity.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Trump obviously uses his own celebrity as part of his appeal. People basically, probably a large section of the American public voted for him because he was already famous, because they knew who he was from The Apprentice and things like
telly.
That.
Telly, yeah.
And if you're famous, then obviously that must mean you have some authority, you have some reason for people to listen to what you have to say.
Yeah, whereas actually it just means that you've got lots of currency and people recognise you. So perhaps as part of it is, oh, I recognise him, I know him, I've heard him before, and I like what he says.
Yeah.
You know, I'm unaware that Jennifer Aniston plays a character and somebody else writes it for her. And possibly the same for Trump. Who knows? Certainly on The Apprentice, that was probably the case.
But Trump, of course, doesn't just rely on his own celebrity. He also likes to invoke other celebrities from time to time.
Tom Brady likes me. What can I tell you? I think so. If Tom Brady likes you, you're in pretty good shape.
So this was during the campaign. He was talking about how Tom Brady was kind of endorsing him as president. Tom Brady is, I'm sorry to all the people who don't like Tom Brady, he is a great football player. He just is.
He's an expert in football.
He's an expert quarterback, but doesn't necessarily know any more than you do about what would make someone a good president.
No.
And so we shouldn't probably give his opinion any weight when we're deciding who to vote for.
Yeah.
But that's what Trump is implying here, is saying, you know, Tom Brady likes me, therefore you should probably vote for me to be president.
Yeah, so because part of it is rubbing off because Tom Brady is great, so therefore I must be great.
Yeah.
If Tom Brady likes me, you know, some of that greatness that he has is imparting to me, and you could be like Tom Brady.
Yeah, Tom Brady likes me.
It's that.
Be like Tom Brady and like me.
exactly, yeah. It's like that, and that kind of short, that steps over the fact that if you vote for Trump, you don't automatically turn into Tom Brady overnight. You don't become an expert quarterback or indeed a handsome guy that Ted and Mark Wahlberg in Ted 1 want to steal the sperm from, you know, because they reckon he would be a good father.
So. But at least Tom Brady is an expert in something. He is an authority, just not about that. But sometimes people invoke non experts or non-authorities. And in March of 2016, Trump claimed on Fox and Friends that Ted Cruz's father knew Lee Harvey Oswald.
His father was with Lee Harvey Oswald prior to Oswald's being, you know, shot. I mean, the whole thing is ridiculous. What is this, right prior to his being shot? And nobody even brings it up. I mean, they don't even talk about that. That was reported, and nobody talks about it. But I think it's horrible.
So this is kind of a guilt by association thing. He's trying to associate Ted Cruz through his father to a negative person. But when he was actually called on to defend these comments, which are completely mad, he invoked an authority.
Now, I don't know what it was exactly, but it was a major story in a major publication, and it was picked up by many other publications.
So this is something Trump likes to do, is like, if he's called out on something that he got wrong, he says, well, I read it somewhere, or I heard about it, or lots of people are telling me this. And here he says it's a major story in a major publication. The major publication that Trump saw the story in was the National Enquirer.
Well, actually, there's an appeal to authority there, because just on the basis that the National Enquirer sells a lot of copies, you know, it kind of imbues it with some majority. It is a major publication. Well, yeah, in the world of crazy land, it's kind of...
it's an authority in that sense, But this is, the thing is, in terms of news sources, this is the tabloid that claimed that Judge Antonin Scalia was murdered by a prostitute who was hired by the CIA to assassinate him by injecting poison into his buttocks.
Yeah.
MediaBiasFactCheck.com describes National Enquirer as the original fake news media outlet that profits by selling fake news.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, and it is, well, mind you, it was called upon in Men in Black, the movie, to be the true reporter of what's gone down.
That's true.
It kind of calls it out, says it's terrible, and then uses it as a butt of a joke as well. Whereas Trump thinks it's a major publication, and he just kind of does that stuff. Well, it was a major story run in a major publication, picked up by other publications. Really? Do you think other publications actually scour the National Enquirer? They can't wait. They're hanging around by the newsstand.
Well, I think it was probably other publications said the National Enquirer is saying this crazy shit. So,
yeah, and Trump or Trump has referred to an article in. Yeah, that's called picking it up, isn't it? Trump has gone crazy again because he thinks the National Enquirer is a leading journalistic, you know, the stuff of Bob Woodward. Well, there we go. Yeah.
So if you're going to invoke an authority, make sure that they're actually an authority in that particular area in question.
And now is the time, I think, for Mark's British Politics Corner.
Okay, so this week my example comes from the Independent newspaper, which is a fairly authoritative newspaper, a broadsheet in the UK, and it was published on the 14th of December 2018, so this Christmas. It was an exclusive interview with that well-known political commentator, Paloma Faith. And I assume she's a political commentator because the headline that they ran was, "Theresa May should step down. She's made a shit show of Brexit. Her career is over." So I was beguiled by the fact that she... I didn't know this branch to Paloma Faith's talents. And it's a print interview, and I suspect there isn't an audio version. I looked all over to see if there was an audio version, and I suspect that I'll be committing a fallacy based on the fact that I'm not convinced by her authoritative tone. But this was, I think this is why they haven't published an audio one. This is her doing a trail for an appearance on a radio show a couple of days later.
Good morning, everyone. I'm on my way to speak to and sing with Chris Evans on BBC Radio 2. I hope you all enjoy the show.
So there you can see the voice, the authoritative tones of political commentator Paloma Faith. So she says, you know, she said Theresa May should step down. She's made a shit show of Brexit. Her career is over. So I'm thinking, well, why have the Independent newspaper given her a massive amount of space. What makes her an authority? She's got 471,000 followers on Instagram, 592,000 on Twitter. She sings a bit like Amy Winehouse. Does that give her the authority to kind of pontificate on political matters? Or is it because, as she continues, her partner is a French passport holder, her dad is Spanish, and her mum's English. And she's trying to get dual citizenship for herself with Spain. And then she says, I don't know if it's possible because we haven't got a deal yet. It's scary. So maybe her political authority is because she's simply like an individual affected by Brexit, by the rest of us.
But this is the thing with the appeal to celebrity aspect of it, isn't it? It's that celebrities' opinions are more important than everyone else's. They do the vox pops, they go out in the street and talk to the regular people, but if you could manage to find a celebrity, that's the one that's going to make the news.
Paloma Faith also said, even though it's kind of scary, she feels optimistic about the new generation. And she says, young people seem much more clued up and I'm hoping they're going to save it all. So the implication is she isn't clued up herself, in which case, why is she given column inches under an overt political headline?
Maybe she's not including herself in the not clued up generation or the
section. Could be, yeah. Or it could be that she's just got a new album out.
Yeah, that might be it.
You know, so there, yeah.
It could be that her publicist is just calling around newspapers saying, have you got anything you'd like Paloma Faith to talk about?
Yeah, exactly. In which case you kind of think, oh, okay, well, what's in the headlines? Okay, Brexit. Yeah, let's get her to tell us what she thinks of Theresa May. So my other thought was that that actually perhaps the Independent is doing this kind of meta-satirical thing. What they're saying is that she has no more authority to talk about these things than self-employed entertainers relying on keeping in favour with the public to guarantee an income stream, people like Boris Johnson. So they're doing this kind of sly bit of satire, saying, OK, yes, here's Paloma Faith banging on about these things. She isn't a good authority on which to listen to this, and neither is Boris Johnson, just a shameless media whore, just like Paloma Faith is, you know, without saying as much. Yeah. So speaking of which, my second example is, I think, knowing that you're an authority is a dangerous thing. And I think Boris Johnson knows that he's an authority and plays on that. Well, let's face it, he has no skills other than his position of authority to call upon. He's not an expert in anything other than being a politician. I'm a politician, therefore you need to listen to me. So this week, in fact, there'd been a judgment on what he said back in August, where he came for a lot of criticism about a comment on women who wear burqas, which he made in his Daily Telegraph column back in August. And it kind of starts all right. He says, if you say that it is weird and bullying to expect women to cover their faces, then I totally agree. And I would add that I can find no scriptural authority for the practice in the Quran. So you kind of go, oh, okay, yeah. So there you are actually saying there is no authority. I'm trying to appeal to an authority about practice of wearing burqas, and I can find none. So, which is pretty good. So he's sounding fairly ministerial, even though he resigned on July the 9th as the Foreign Secretary. But he's still an elected MP. He's a member of the Conservative Party in power. So he's in a position where an authority is implied from what he says. And then he goes on to say, and I wish he didn't, he says, I would go further and say that it is absolutely ridiculous that people should choose to go around looking like letterboxes. So now he's descended from, if you were to say this, then I would agree too. I'm saying these people look like letterboxes, which as a person in authority is
kind of amazing.
You know, kind of a lot of implied racism there.
A little bit.
There was an inquiry because the Conservative Party's code of conduct states that its representatives, and he was a representative, must support equality of opportunity, diversity and inclusion, and encourage and foster respect and tolerance. So on the 22nd of December, an independent panel found his use of language in the column could be considered provocative, but claimed, kind of freedom of speech stuff, that it'd be unwise to censor excessively the language of party representatives or the use of satire to emphasise a viewpoint, particularly a viewpoint that is not subject to criticism. Another authority came back, which is the Muslim Council of Britain, which is a Muslim authority, says, well, he isn't a satirist, he's a member of parliament, and as such, he has a responsibility to set the tone for the rest of the UK to follow. And if the code of conduct says it must be must foster respect and tolerance, how do these remarks foster respect and tolerance? And in fact, on the website, the independent page, somebody says, a guy called Andy Frankiefile, on Christmas Eve, says, this seems a strange conclusion for a committee to come to, and ask the questions, what is the composition of the independent committee? Who paid for it? Were any of its members of a Muslim religion or ethnicity? What were the terms of reference and what procedures did it follow? Which makes me think, okay, is that a valid and effective counter?
Yeah, I think in a way he is in that comment asking for what the authority is, what the committee is basing their decision on, and whether they actually have any expertise in that area. It seems reasonable to say that there should be people who know, who are either Muslim themselves or know a great deal about Muslim religion and Muslim people, to make a judgment on whether that would be disrespectful or intolerant or, you know, upsetting to that demographic.
Is what the Muslim Council of Britain say, is what they are saying a reasonable thing to say? I think it is. Or is it just that it's difficult to accept the authority of someone with whom one disagrees?
That's definitely a factor, yes. I think it is just genuinely difficult for everyone, no matter how hard you try, to objectively treat sources with which you agree the same as sources with which you disagree. It is absolutely a cognitive bias that exists, that people will favour more people
who
agree.
But that kind of, my fear is that at some stage you've got to accept that there is an authority. And how do you best do that? Because the thing about the argument for authority is that everything becomes subjective.
If you are being intellectually honest, you can accept that some people have a level of expertise in a particular area. Now, that's not to say that if someone is an expert in a particular area, that they're always right. That's also a factor. They could be an expert. They could be the world's leading expert in something and still be wrong.
Yeah.
It's not sensible to say that just because this person says it, it's definitely true. But if they say it and they back it up and they have looked into it and you know that they are an expert in that specific area, it's more likely to be true. That's something you can be fairly certain of.
Fallacy, a fallacy, it's a fallacy in the wild. It's a fallacy, a fallacy in the wild.
Very Christmassy.
A very Christmassy version there. There we are.
Okay, so in the Fallacy in the Wild, we like to talk about the fallacy of the week from a non-political point of view. And this week we've got the first example is from a little known, I would say probably, sitcom, which I think it was in the 90s. And it was...
I loved it.
It is great. Yeah, it's called Dinosaurs.
Yeah.
And it's a live-action sitcom featuring people dressed up as dinosaurs. And it's very much a kind of a family dynamic like the Honeymooners or the Simpsons or the Flintstones. It's that kind of, you know, brash, abrasive father and kids and a baby and stuff like that. So anyway, it's very funny. And in one episode, the teenage daughter of the family doesn't believe that the Earth is flat. and ends up actually getting taken to court for this. And this happens in the courtroom.
Your Honor, the flatness of the earth is one of the most hallowed precepts of dinosaur tradition. Yet there are those among us who would require some proof that the world is flat. Fair enough. Let the record show that I now offer absolute and unimpeachable evidence. A guy in a lab coat. You are an engineer with lots of impressive degrees.
That is correct.
And you work at the We Say So Corporation.
That is also correct. The Classroom Globe Division.
And just what have you brought here to show us today?
Only this! And we have a warehouse full of these things. Proof enough for you, Missy.
Very impressive.
That's it, friend. We're in trouble now.
Obviously, if a company the size of We Say So throws the full weight of its corporate clout behind the concept of a flat earth, who are we to question?
Well, I'm sold. Guilty.
So the prop that the guy in a lab coat brings into the court is a flat globe, essentially, a kind of structure, yeah, that is
a
just
disc,
a, yeah, it's a disc.
Isn't it? Yeah. So, it's like a desk globe, but instead of a ball, it's just got a flat disc with the earth on, you know, map on top of it.
Yeah.
It's brilliant. I so want one of those. On my
that would
desk.
Be great. Yeah. So, the lawyer in this case is invoking the authority of the guy in the lab coat, unimpeachable evidence. The fact that he is an engineer with lots of impressive degrees, and he works for the We Say So Corporation, which is a big corporation and therefore wouldn't put all of their weight and money behind something which wasn't true. So he's multiple levels of argument from authority there, none of which make it more likely that actually the world is flat.
But I love that appeal to here's unimpeachable evidence, a guy in a lab coat.
No one goes,
and he's kind of going, well, yeah, that's the basis of all expertise, isn't it?
Yeah. There's an XKCD comic as well, where someone in a lab coat is telling someone something ridiculous about their health and their medical prognosis, and the caption is, "You know, you can just buy lab coats."
Yeah. So there you go. The implication is you wear a white coat, you're an expert. Yeah. And you can just buy them. Yeah.
So our second example is from Fox News, and it was when a video game called Mass Effect came out. Now, if you're a gamer, you've probably heard of Mass Effect, and you might know that it's a very kind of sprawling game with lots of decisions that you can make along the way. Mm-hmm. And one of the things about the game was that you could trigger a sex scene. And Fox News were incensed by this. They said it was basically showing sex to children, and it's like, one of them described it as like Debbie Does Dallas in space, which is brilliant. And the US Video Games Ratings Board gave it an M for games. It's the film equivalent would be an R. So they had on Fox News to talk about this someone who knew about games and someone who was an expert in child psychology.
And here's how they're seeing women. They're seeing them as these objects of desire, as these, you know, hot bodies. I mean, they don't show women as being valued for anything other than their sexuality. And it's a man in this game deciding how many women he wants to be with.
All right, let's get Jeff in on this.
All right, that's completely incorrect. Yeah, it's completely incorrect. First of all, you can actually play as a man or a woman in the game. Cooper, have you ever played Mass Effect?
No.
So, not only has this person who is commenting on the dangers of this game never played the game, she finds it laughable that she would even be asked whether she played it or not.
Yeah, I'm a figure of authority. You don't need to actually get me to do the damn thing. You know, I know what I'm talking about. I don't need to test it.
But this woman, Cooper, who's a psychologist, she had a book out. Which was why she was on Fox News talking about this. Amusingly, after this, lots of people went to Amazon and reviewed her book and said that it was terrible, but they hadn't read it. They didn't feel they needed to read it before reviewing it.
Oh, that's excellent. That's brilliant.
And in this area, I actually, myself, am a little bit of an authority, because I was on the team that classified Mass Effect in the UK, and we gave it a 12 in the UK, because although there is a sex scene in it, All of the hype and all of the scare about how awful this was that they were showing kids sex and you were kind of having a game where you did sex and stuff like that was nonsense.
Right.
What happened was it's a very, very immersive game. It's lots and lots of worlds that you can go and explore and do stuff on. And it's about 30 hours or so to play the game from start to finish. And there is a section where if you have made various decisions which lead you to have a relationship with another crew member on this ship, then one of the decision trees will lead you down to a very mild sex scene where you see a bit of alien buttock and a bit of side boob, and that's it. And then it's over in about 30 seconds, and then you move on.
Right.
You can't kind of continually choose to have sex. Yeah. You can't press a button and decide to have sex. There's no interactivity in the sex at all. You can't. We said at the time that if it was a game where you had sex in the game and you were actually kind of doing some kind of interactivity to get them
exactly
that wouldn't have been 12 because no parent wants to kind of walk in and see that their 12-year-old making a character on screen have sex with another character. But that wasn't the case. It was a video clip.
With teddy bears.
Yeah, it was a video clip that followed a decision tree that you choose various options on. Yeah. And it was really, really mild. It wasn't an issue for us at all. So it was 12. But this person who was talking about how terrible it was hadn't played the game. So they're not an authority on it.
What they are is the kind of the vocal minority. There was a vocal minority called the Festival of Light in the 1970s, run by this particular woman, Mary Whitehouse, who was your archetypal librarian with horn-rim glasses who would be upset at a flash of ankle, who would ironically get out all the video nasties and all the films that you wouldn't normally want to watch and then watch them and be upset about them and then complain about them.
She made a real special effort to be outraged, didn't she, Mary Whitehouse?
Exactly, yeah. And that was, that would lead her to write directly to the British Board of Film Censors, your film certificate. I think it was Film Censors still
at
called
the time,
then.
Yeah.
Your previous employer, and complain.
Yeah, what she would actually do was write to the Mail, mostly, who would run stories that said things like, ban this sick filth. And what that resulted in was the Video Recordings Act in 1984, which it started because in the early 80s, when video players came along, VHS players, you could actually buy any film, including video nasties and Italian horror films and sex and all kinds of stuff, just in the high street, with no age restrictions at all.
Yeah.
And following 1984 and the Video Recordings Act, that meant that somebody had to watch everything and give it a rating. And so she actually quite contributed to the BBFC becoming a significantly more important organisation. And I wouldn't have worked there if not for that, because they wouldn't have needed more than a few people.
Oh, well, there you go. Well, she's something to be grateful for.
Absolutely. Yeah.
If not the sale of horn-rimmed glasses.
So I've got another example, which is actually a real-world example.
And
this is because it's Christmas, seeing family, and yesterday went over to my mum's house and had a chat with my sister, who, for some reason, the talk got around to talking about antibiotics and about how you should always finish the course of antibiotics. Right. And she said, well, that's not true. That's not true anymore, because they've now said that you shouldn't finish the course and you should just stop when you feel better. And I said, well, that doesn't sound right. That's not what I've heard, and that's not what they say generally. And she said, no, it's true, and looked it up on her phone and found an article that said it, that said this is what's happened. And she said, and I've got a friend who's a nurse who says this is true. So that was an argument from authority, because this nurse friend of hers, who, may well know a lot about antibiotics, realistically, probably her experience is anecdotal. It's probably, if she does have particular experience of knowing whether antibiotics have been continued or stopped and whether people have recovered, is from seeing patients. And almost certainly she doesn't know whether those patients have had problems with bacterial resistance that's been caused by stopping courses of antibiotics and so on, because she's not a molecular biologist, she's not a research scientist, she's a person in the medical profession but doesn't have precise knowledge of this. I wanting to be a critical thinker, said that, OK, I'm not going to dismiss this new piece of information. I will go away, I'll look at it, I'll be interested. And I looked into it, and it is very interesting. And what I found was there was an article in the British Medical Journal, not a study, not research, just an article, an opinion piece that had been written by some doctors and some scientists to say that actually the advice on finishing the course and the advice on the length of courses of antibiotics was based on not a lot of data. It wasn't based on enough research. It was based on tradition. And the reason that it was tradition is because our prescribing guidelines for things like antibiotics are based back when they decided that you just needed to give lots so that it would be cured and they weren't worried about resistance because they didn't really understand it. And now that we understand resistance, what we want to do is minimise the amount of antibiotics use. And so to make sure that we're giving the right amount and not too much, we should be testing and finding out what the right dose is that will do that. It didn't say people should decide for themselves when to stop, or they should stop when they feel better. But all of the press, the Independent, the Guardian, the Mail and so on, all said, you know, everything you know about antibiotics is wrong. Doctors now say you should stop antibiotics when you feel better and all that kind of stuff. Which is not only wrong, it's dangerous. Because some things, like tuberculosis and other things, if you stop the course too early, does increase the likelihood that your bacterial infection will grow resistant to those antibiotics. And it's that's not what the article said. It said that we should do more testing. We should find out more.
So there is a danger from the point of view of the appeal to authority. So the newspapers who are reporting on this stuff need to be responsible for, which is they are an authority. So if the Guardian or the Independent, you know, the broadsheet newspapers, even and the Daily Mail, if they report this stuff, their reporting comes with the weight of many years of respectable journalism being attributed to them, such that people will believe what they print.
Yeah, and that authority is based on tradition as well, because back in the day, there were science reporters on newspapers who did have science degrees and who would, when they read a new science study, look into it. They would read the study. They would go back and decide, you know, if they believed it based on the number of people in the study and things like that. And because newspapers are losing money and have been for some time now, they don't have science reporters much anymore, and it will generally just be farmed out to an average workaday journalist who doesn't either have the time, the inclination, or the expertise to really understand what they're writing about in some cases.
And also in these days of, you know, actual print newspapers going under and becoming online, you've got to do clickbaity headlines where people will click through, which means that you can report to your advertisers that you had this many hits on your page and therefore this many people looked at your adverts. So you do more and more clickbaity headlines, not unlike Paloma Faith says Theresa May is shit and ought to step down. So, you know, the reason I got onto that was because it came up in the Brexit. Some, you know, the my feed sends me stuff about Brexit and that came up. And you kind of go, oh, bloody hell, Theresa May is shit. She ought to step down. You click on it and you go, oh, it's Paloma Faith. But it is clickbait. So,
and now that's another interesting thing, is because in some cases we do look at it the other way and think, well, that person isn't an expert in this area, therefore they don't know what they're talking about, therefore their opinion is wrong. And again, that's not necessarily the case. They might actually have a valid opinion or a true opinion. It's not necessarily based on the kind of evidence that we want to base our opinions on, and therefore we shouldn't give it a lot of weight, but it doesn't mean they're wrong. And in fact, interestingly, this opinion piece in the British Medical Journal, they listed the authors and their credentials. And it was multiple authors, and a lot of them had, you know, they were experts in microbiology or epidemiology and things like that. But one of the authors was listed as Cliff Gorton. And in the footnotes of giving their credentials, he was a retired building surveyor. That's it.
Right.
Now, I have no idea what the hell right. this person knows about antibiotics? And there was no attempt to explain their attributed why.
Authority. Yeah.
It's really odd that he was listed as an author of this piece in the BMJ with no other explanation of why anyone should listen to anything he wrote. I don't know what he did. Maybe he's a retired building surveyor and now he's a copywriter, and he helped them to kind of punch up the copy a bit, make it sound a bit more interesting after the scientists all put the science in. We don't know.
So was there anything in the article particularly about buildings?
No.
Surveying of them?
No. Oddly, it was mostly antibiotics-based.
Clue?
Yeah.
Oh, right.
This is our final show of the year, so before we play fake news tonight, there's just time for a quick roundup of Trump's 2018. Mark?
Okay. It was a fucking dumpster fire.
Thanks very much.
So we're gonna play
fake news, folks. I love the game. It's a great game.
I understand the game as well as anybody. As well as anybody.
Now, this is usually the part of the show where I read out three Trump quotes and get Mark to guess which one I made up. But it's the end of the year, you know, it's Christmas party season.
Yeah,
we like to play different games at Christmas time, and I thought I'd mix it up a bit, really. So, inspired by Trump's appearance in the Christmas classic Home Alone 2, I thought I would ask you about other films that Trump has appeared in cameo roles.
Oh, wow.
So.
Oh, very.
And the interesting thing is, according to Matt Damon, I think, who said that when he was making a film that was... took part partly in a Trump property. The only way they were allowed to use the property was if they also they wrote a part for Trump in the film. So they didn't necessarily have to include it in the final cut, but they had to write a part, they had to film it, they had to waste their time on set, you know, with like Al Pacino against, you know, talking to Trump. And that was how he got into So he's in quite a lot of films, actually. But...
Oh, my God.
So we've got three rounds. So you've got the opportunity to gain quite a lot of points here. Each round is right, I'm going to give you three films, and you have to tell me which one Trump did a cameo in. Okay?
Okay.
So, round one.
Cool.
Right. Was Trump in 2 Weeks' Notice, Three Men and a Baby, or Four Weddings and a Funeral?
Wow. Ooh. Okay, a nice number theme there, by the way. Which one out of the three?
Yeah, he was in one of those films.
Okay. Wow. Oh. Well, I think probably Against All Odds. No, not the film. I think unexpectedly he would be in Four Weddings, so I think he was in Four Weddings and Funeral.
I'm afraid not. No, he was in...
No!
He was in 2 Weeks' Notice, the Hugh Grant and Sandra Bullock, let's call it a comedy.
Oh!
So I've got a clip of Trump acting against Hugh Grant here.
Wade!
Trump!
I hear Kelson finally dumped you.
Not exactly, no. We just came to a mutual understanding that she couldn't bear me for another second.
So there we go. It wasn't a big role.
Wow! No.
If ever you want to show that your characters are kind of important and rich and live in New York, then Trump is a person that you insert into your film.
In the 90s. Yes. Yeah. And if your characters are in the 90s, so do you think like the series 10 of Stranger Things, they will do it in a haunted Trump Tower where the upside down, actually the king of the upside down, would be Trump himself.
Could be.
Yeah. But his hair kind of flopping away. Yeah. Wow. Well, how about that? And not only, see, numbers and Hugh Grant there. Good theme. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Wow. Okay. Right. I've got the measure of you now,
round
Jim.
Round two.
Give me the next one.
Round two is a TV round. So did Trump appear in an episode of Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, The Golden Girls, or Friends?
Okay. Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. Ooh, that'd be interesting. Yeah. Well, because that's the wrong side of the country for Trump. the Golden Girls, I think they would have found him kind of quite sexy. What was the last one?
Friends.
Ah, oh, dear. I think probably to their eternal shame if he was in there. Ooh. I want it to be the Golden Girl, but I'm edging towards Friends. But I think it's probably the Golden Girls.
Okay. I'm afraid you're wrong again.
Oh, my God, really? It was Friends.
It wasn't Friends. No, it was the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. So, yeah, I did put Friends in there because I thought New York, that might kind of swing you. But, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
He did appear in an episode of Fresh Prince of Bel-Air where
they
were selling their house. And Trump came in as a potential buyer.
Yeah.
So here's a clip.
Ron said his client had a rich uncle, but Donald Trump.
I like keeping a low profile.
Yeah. So there was a little bit more to it.
Wow.
Yeah. And in fact, his wife at the time, I think it was probably Marla Maples, was in it as well. They appeared together. So.
Bloody hell. Wow. That's amazing, isn't it? Oh, yeah. All right. So, yeah. So you could, like, Will Smith refused to appear on screen with him.
No, Will went and shook his hand. He said, he said, if you do buy the house and you want someone to come and mow the lawn, if you chuck in an extra 50 grand, I'll come and do it for you.
He is the kid that mows the lawn. Wow. Oh, my God. So. Wow. Or the nerdy nephew. No, the nerdy cousin.
Yeah, Carlton. He was very excited.
These kind of Trump's his kind of people.
Yeah, but it turned out the story of the episode was that he wanted to buy it because it was like his nephew had lived there as a child or something like that. But it turned out they'd got the address wrong, and his nephew lived in a different house, so they didn't.
But you ended up buying it anyway. Oh, he didn't.
No.
Oh, okay.
No.
All right.
So.
Wow. Oh my God! I've got to go. The horrible thing is
you're going to have to watch that episode.
I know. It's appalling, isn't it? It'll be awful.
Final round. Your last chance to gain a point.
Okay.
Was Trump in White Men Can't Jump, Can't Buy Me Love, or Ghosts Can't Do It?
White Man Can't Jump. Well, it would be, yeah, I could see him with Woody Harrelson. That would kind of work. Can't Buy Me Love. When was that set? That was set in the 60s?
No, that was a John Cusack film, I think. No, it was Patrick Dempsey.
Oh, okay.
Patrick Dempsey was the...
Yep.
Unrelated to the Beatles, apart from the desperate stealing of the name.
Desperate.
It was 1987.
And what was it?
Last one was Ghosts Can't Do It.
Goats Can't Do It. Ghosts Can't Do It. Well, you see, I'm tempted to go for the one that nobody's ever heard of, but I think I want it to be White Men Can't Jump. I just want it to be that because I want to hear Woody Harrelson talk to Trump. It isn't, is it? I've lost it again.
I'm afraid it's the one that no one's ever heard of. It's Ghosts Can't Do It, which is a 1989 Bo Derek comedy about a widow who, I don't know, her husband dies, who's Anthony Quinn is her husband. He dies and comes back as a ghost and talks her through a business deal that involves Trump in for some reason. their interaction includes this line.
But be assured, Mrs. Scott, that in this room there are knives sharp enough to cut you to the bone and hearts cold enough to eat yours as hors d'oeuvres.
So that's Trump being a tough businessman there.
Yeah, you could tell.
And I couldn't...
Because his voice is slightly lower.
I couldn't include a clip of Bo Derek because her acting is so bad, it can't be recorded.
Don't give her any lines.
Yeah, so it's weird.
It's like, ghosts can't be recorded, Wow. Oh, my word. What year was that?
That was 1989. And in fact, Trump won a Razzie, a Golden Raspberry, for his appearance in that film as Worst Actor.
But that witch is saying something next to Bo Derek. Wow, well, there you go. Bloody hell, he's been all over, hasn't he? I'm surprised. Why did they even keep it in there? Oh, that's the question, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, you could... Yeah, yeah. Well, I guess the, you know, the thing about buying and selling property in...
that kind of makes sense.
Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, that's quite a good... You know, I would have cut that from the entire series and shot a different one. But, you know, that makes sense as part of the thing. But getting him back in a kind of really poor Patrick Swayze kind of knockoff of Ghost. Was there any clay involved in
no, that there was one? It was weird.
No.
The whole thing that Anthony Quinn was married to Bo Derek was weird enough. But...
Well, we've seen weirder things, like Trump being married to Melania, for instance.
Yeah. So I'm going to treat those...
Great.
Since you lost every single one of those, I'm going to be kind.
Yeah.
And I'm going to treat that as a single loss. Because one overall...
That's very
loss.
Kind.
So that means you're down to 20% in your success rate in the fake news. So next time... Podcast listeners will be back to fake Trump quotes, and I need your help to fool Mark. So if you think you can make up a convincing fake Trump quote, then share this episode on Twitter, include your quote and the hashtag Fallacious Trump. I'll pick the best one, and you'll be podcast famous. So it's time for the part of the show that this week, at least, is called Christmas is Not a Logical Fallacy. We like to talk about all of the crazy stuff that's happened in the last couple of weeks in the Trump orbit, and there's a lot. There's a lot of crazy stuff over Christmas.
Oh, my God, there's so much.
You know how they have a kind of a Friday news dump where, because no one's really talking about stuff on Friday evening, they put the big stories there. Well, they've done a holiday news dump and just lots of stuff has come
out. Right.
But we're going to not talk about any of that stuff because it's Christmas.
No.
We're going to talk about the war on Christmas.
The war on Christmas. Yeah.
Which is a totally real thing and not made up at all.
Yeah.
So Trump said, in fact, he's said it a few times. He said in the campaign that he would bring Christmas back and people would be saying Merry Christmas again if he was made president. Because obviously before that, no one was saying Merry Christmas.
Making Christmas merry again.
Yeah.
Now why didn't I get a t-shirt with that this Christmas? That would have been great, wouldn't it? With Trump in a kind of Santa beard.
Make Christmas
yellow.
Yeah.
Kind of. Making Christmas merry again.
And at last year's tree lighting ceremony, he said that he brought Christmas back to the White House. Brought Merry Christmas back, actually. He said that. Kind of implying that the Obamas didn't say Merry Christmas. Which they very much did, and there's a few compilations online of all the times, all the many times that people have found of the Obamas saying Merry Christmas. They also did say Happy Holidays, because that is a recognition that Christmas isn't the only thing that exists, and there's also Hanukkah and Kwanzaa and other things. And New Year, for that matter, which is included in the kind of the holiday season. Yeah, it hasn't been very consistent. Yeah. The other members of the Trump family, Ivanka Trump last year put out a tweet saying Happy Holidays, which probably people didn't like. But the interesting thing is that this month there's been a poll by Morning Consult who have asked people what they actually think about people saying Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays, and if they care, basically. So they asked the question, if a store or business used the term Happy Holidays or Merry Christmas, would that make you more or less likely to shop there, or would it make no difference either way?
Right.
And what they found was for all adults, just generally across the board, if people say Merry Christmas, that makes 42% of people more likely to shop there. It makes no difference to 49% of people. It makes it less likely to, I think, about 2% of people. And if they say Happy Holidays, that actually makes 22% of people more likely to shop there. It makes it 56% of people don't care at all. And 14% of people are less likely to shop there. So it's not that massive. It's not that big a deal.
No.
But the interesting...
Actually, more people don't care at all.
Yeah, loads of people. But basically, the majority of people don't care overall. what people say. But it does break down across party lines quite interestingly. Democrats, 5% of people are less likely to shop in a shop that says Merry Christmas. And 6% are less likely to shop in a shop that says Happy Holidays.
Yeah.
Whereas for Republicans, it's 1% who say they would be less, and I don't understand this at all, they'd be less likely to shop in a shop that says Merry Christmas, even though they're Republican.
Right.
But they're 20% less likely. 20% of them are less likely to shop in a shop that says Happy Holidays.
Oh.
Even then, that's 80% of people who don't give a fuck, doesn't make any difference to them.
Yeah.
Even in the Republican Party.
And actually, looking at the makes no difference bit, for Republicans, 36% say that Merry Christmas makes no difference. Yeah. 48% say Happy Holidays makes no difference. So, 80% of people, including more people than if said Merry Christmas, give a shit about whether they say Happy Holidays.
Yeah.
Yeah. So so it's a completely made up thing.
It is completely made up. It came from the early 2000s, between 2000 and 2003.
Oh, okay. As recent as
talk
that.
Show. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, to be fair, there is a history of it. There are people who were saying even back in the like 40s and 50s, as soon as they saw something that didn't say Merry Christmas, they were saying, you don't see Merry Christmas anywhere anymore. But it really became a thing in the Republican Party with talk show hosts, conservative talk show hosts, like Bill O'Reilly, in 2003, particularly.
Good old friend Bill O'Reilly.
And Bill Donahue in the Catholic League. He started talking about how you don't see Christmas anymore and how Christmas in schools was being censored because they put up things that acknowledged cultural traditions other than Christianity or sang Frosty the Snowman instead of Silent Night.
But as well as...
Absolutely. But that's the thing. When you're used to being in charge, any concession to anyone else is oppressive to you. That's the thing.
Yeah, exactly.
It's
when
you
you're
being attacked.
A white supremacist.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You're having to concede, 2% or something.
Yeah. Just accepting that other people exist.
Down your empire,
right to their opinion is unacceptable.
Yeah.
So in 2003, O'Reilly jumped on board and started talking about how Christmas is taking flak. It said he said in 2003, he said, in Denver this past weekend, no religious floats were permitted in the holiday parade there. In New York City, Mayor Bloomberg unveiled the holiday tree and no Christian Christmas symbols were allowed in the public schools. In Macy's, they've done away with Christmas greeting Merry Christmas. In Macy's, they did start saying Happy Holidays that year because, again, they were trying to be inclusive. They were trying to say they're not celebrating Christmas. And if you go Macy's, if you went to Macy's in 2003, they had Christmas decorations and including religious ones and Merry Christmas on things. They just generally told their staff to stay happy.
They're kind of thinking, New York's going to be filled with Catholics, non-Catholics, non-Christians, and we're a shop trying to sell stuff.
There was an incident in 2005 when Walmart, a woman complained that they were saying Happy Holidays instead of Merry Christmas. And so an employee...
One woman.
Yeah. And so a Walmart customer service employee emailed her to say, the majority of the world still has different practices other than Christmas, which is an ancient tradition that has its roots in Siberian shamanism. Santa is borrowed from the Caucasus, mistletoe from the Celts, Yule log from the Goths, and this the thyme from the Visigoth and the tree from the worship of Baal. that employee was fired from Walmart.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, but not immediately. Yeah. That must have happened after somebody complained.
Yeah, well, Bill Donahue of the Catholic League complained.
Oh,
he called it discrimination,
practiced
by cultural fascists, and he called for a boycott of Walmart. And
and what he's espousing isn't cultural fascism.
No,
at all.
Of course not. No.
So
Walmart apologized. They said that their greeters should say Merry Christmas again, and they fired the employee.
But why?
Involved.
Well, mainly because Bill Donahue is
why not?
An argument from authority and was saying, given my authority, I'm going to get everybody to boycott Walmart, and Walmart are going, shit, nobody's going to buy anything. Let's fire the guy.
But even in 2005, Gallup did a poll, and 41% of people said they preferred to hear Happy Holidays. 56% said they'd rather hear Merry Christmas. But it's still pretty close. It's not that far off.
Yeah.
Bill O'Reilly was keeping on saying this for several years, but by the kind of late 2000s, 2008, 2009, he was claiming that he'd won basically the war on Christmas, and that Macy's were saying Merry Christmas again, and all of the main stores, they all had it on. But it hasn't stopped anyone else. World. Every single year, it hasn't stopped Fox from saying any time that, you know, there's a school nativity scene that is it has to include a snowman, that's an attack on Christianity.
Or because of somebody putting, you know, happy Xmas instead of Merry Christmas.
Yeah.
Is it, what the hell? You know, that's the counter argument, isn't it?
Yeah, the Xmas one is interesting because the X in Xmas comes from the Greek initial for Christ. So it is a traditional shortening of Christmas, but Christians can't decide whether it's trivializing Christmas and therefore bad, and then if any people who use Xmas say, well, no, this is a completely valid Christian tradition, then they say, yeah, but that's not how you meant it. You know, I don't believe that all the people who are saying Xmas know that, so therefore it's negative.
Yeah,
even though it's
it doesn't matter. So there's moving the goalposts going on. I always thought it was just kind of shorthand for cross.
Yeah, Christmas.
You know, Merry Christmas.
No, it comes from Christos.
Wow.
Learn something.
Cool. And finally, some things we really don't have time to talk about.
Trump shut down the federal government for the third time this year, just before Christmas, presumably based on the assumption that the Mueller investigation will have to stop while the shutdown's in effect. He seems pretty happy to take the credit for the 800,000 federal workers going without pay over Christmas, telling Chuck Schumer earlier in the month that he was proud to shut down the government, claiming many federal workers are telling him they want him to hold out and not pay them, and boasting on Twitter that it's mostly Democrats who aren't getting paid anyway.
The most altruistic charity in the history of charities, which is probably a trademark, the Trump Foundation, is no more. The New York State Attorney General signed a stipulation dissolving the Trump Foundation and argues that the individual Trumps failed to ever hold a board meeting or take board minutes, didn't review foundation assets, liabilities, revenues and disbursements, and neglected to oversee the foundation and or supervise accounting staff. Most damning of all for the president, he solicited funds directly for the foundation, then gave his presidential campaign control over those funds, which it then used to attempt to influence the election. As the Barbara Underwood version of the Good Book says, "And now abideth faith, hope, and charity, these three. But the greatest of these is justice."
For the first time in his presidency, Trump visited US troops overseas on Christmas Day, as he and Melania took an unannounced trip to Iraq. After accidentally revealing the classified whereabouts of covert special ops unit SEAL Team 5, Trump went on to brag about how he personally arranged the military's recent huge pay rise.
Is anybody here willing to give up the big pay raise you just got? Raise your hand, please. Oh, I don't see too many hands. Okay. Don't give it up. It's great. You know what? Nobody deserves it more. You haven't gotten one in more than 10 years. More than 10 years. And we got you a big one. I got you a big one. I got you a big one. They had plenty of people that came up. They said, you know, we could make it smaller. We could make it 3%. We could make it 2%. We could make it 4%. I said, no. Make it 10%. Make it more than 10%. Because it's been a long time. It's been more than 10 years.
So, Mark, Trump said the raise is more than 10%. He said, make it more than 10%. I got a huge pay raise. How much more than 10% do you think the military raise for this year is?
0.1?
It's actually a bit less than 10%. It's 2.6%.
More than 10%?
No, 2.6%.
Oh, so it, what?
It's not 10%.
Uh-huh. So it isn't more than 10%.
It's not 3%.
It's not 4%.
It's 2.6%.
It's 2.6.
Yeah.
It's not more than 10.
No.
And I thought it was going to be 10.1%.
And Trump
it's
says...
It's not even that.
It's not. It's 2.6%. Yeah. And Trump says that it's been more than 10 years since they've had a pay raise. How long do you think it's been?
Okay. Since they had a pay raise. Probably a year.
Yeah. Last year they had a pay raise.
Yeah.
It was about the same. It was about 2.4% last year.
Okay.
And he did not get them the big, massive 2.6% pay raise. No. Yeah, military pay raises are tied to increases in private sector wages. They're calculated by the Department of Labor. They haven't done anything about getting them. No. So he's completely just lying.
So it's just gone up by the cost of living, basically.
Yeah. So.
And they bought it.
Yeah.
They bought it. The whole room just went, yay! You're great! Yeah! What? What? Don't see, there's one kid at the front, you know, going, no, the emperor's not wearing any clothes. Can you not see that?
Yeah.
Can you not see this big lumpy orange guy is stark bollock naked? He's, you know, what are you doing? Can you not see through this tissue of lies? What the hell? How is he going to get away with that?
Yeah. He'll do something else and no one will care.
You don't stand in a room with people who are armed to the teeth and lie to them like that. Yeah. No way. Do you think these guys who get a paycheck every year, every month, they get a pay slip because they've got to fill in their tax return? Uh-huh. So they have to get some paperwork that backs that up so that they can tell the tax man, this is what I earned every year that happens.
Well, I tell you what. It's lucky that because the government is shut down, there are no IRS people watching.
Yeah. There you go.
So they're probably safe.
Ah, good.
Yeah.
So he's not as stupid as he looks. So I didn't think he could be as stupid as he looks. So he knows full well that actually I can get away with saying this shit because nobody's listening. No one's going to record it.
Yeah.
I've just turned up unannounced.
Yeah, it's not like
nobody's going to be here.
And anyone checks it.
No. Nobody's ever seen that. No. What the hell? This past weekend, Trump administration ghoul and noted bald person Stephen Miller appeared on Face the Nation to talk about some presumably pretty racist stuff and show off a fancy new zombie hairline. And because nobody ever watches his appearances with the sound up, no one failed to notice that he looked like he'd been inserted inside that magnetic iron filings facial hair toy, Woolly Willy. Actually, the pubic head triangle was the only alive-looking thing in his chair. Have you seen it? It's just
amazing.
Horrible. It is, and it's completely the wrong colour. It's a fabulous-looking small patch of hair. The rest of it is awful and lank and a different colour.
I've heard a rumour that it's possible that the makeup person, the person kind of who was getting him ready for his appearance on the show, didn't like him. Because if they did, they would have done a much better job. And perhaps it's someone who was a Democrat or someone who was
that's excellent.
Maybe just not a Nazi. And
because they
didn't make any attempt at all to kind of blend it into his existing hair. It was just kind of a lump of fake hair on top of his head.
It moves it forward, you know, in a kind of, you know, Dracula-esque widow's peak way.
Yeah.
And he's never had that. It's not even like a bit thin. So if you shone a lot of strong light from above, you would see the scalp shining. It's just a whole big bunch of hair. You know, Bo Derek would be proud of that pubic triangle on his head. Guarantee it.
Another in the happy family set of dictators, that nice Turkish Mr. Erdogan, told Donald on the phone that he's got ISIS covered now in Syria. So why is Trump's army still there? Righto, said Donald. Let's go, boys. No correlation, of course, with the fact that the State Department later said it had approved the sale of Patriot ground-to-air missiles in Turkey. Even in the face of committing this so-called Obama-like mistake, a senior administration official said it was the president's decision to make, and he made it. He gets to do that. That's his prerogative. How many times do we have to spell it out? Just because you're in charge doesn't mean you're right.
Exactly. London-based eco-friendly construction company EnviroBuild, who feel very strongly that everyone should do everything they can to leave the world in a better way than they found it, bid $25,000 for the right to name a newly found type of Panamanian amphibian, the Sicilian. Caecilians are tropical amphibians that look like large worms or slick snakes. Sometimes it's hard to tell which end is the head and which is the tail, or arse, if you will. Their shiny skin is ringed with drooping skin folds, very pleasingly called anally. It is a vulnerable creature at risk as a result of the US government's current position on climate change. So they have called it Dermophis Donald Trumpi.
Yeah, a short-sighted, slimy, worm-like creature. Excellent.
Exactly, with drooping skin folds. And actually, what it does is eats its own skin.
Yeah, in fact, its children are parasites, aren't they? Because they eat its skin as well to get ahead in life. Works on so many levels.
Works as it shoves it into the faces of its offspring. In order to give them cushy jobs in the White House. Oh no, wait a minute, no.
All Michael Flynn had to do last week was go into the courtroom and accept a light sentence with possibly no jail time, which both his lawyers and Mueller's team had agreed to based on his cooperation as a witness. But, of course, he had to spend a couple of days beforehand saying the FBI had entrapped him, talked to him without his lawyer present, and the mean old agents hadn't told him it was illegal to lie to the FBI. Judge Emmett Sullivan wasn't happy, so he asked Flynn if he had in fact been entrapped. Flynn's lawyer said no. Sullivan asked if Flynn did in fact know that lying to the FBI was a crime. Flynn said yes.
Mm-hmm.
And Sullivan asked if Flynn wanted to recant his guilty plea. Flynn said no. So Sullivan basically told him to go away and think about how he could be more helpful. He offered to sentence Flynn there and then, but said he couldn't promise there wouldn't be jail time, and pointed out that Flynn had basically sold out his country. The sentencing has been postponed.
I love that bit. You can almost see Flynn standing there going, well, there were no signs up at the FBI saying, you know, lying is prohibited.
No running, no heavy petting, no lying to the FBI.
There were no signs up. But, yeah, how could you just not know that? I had no idea that was the case to the FBI.
Yeah, how could the nation's senior security advisor be expected to know that you're not allowed to lie to a federal official? I mean, that's just crazy.
Yeah, of all organisations. Yeah, exactly. Fit for service, draft-dodging, military service jacket-wearing man-chickens. His family owned the building in Jamaica, Queens, where podiatrist Larry Braunstein had his surgical office. Following a letter he wrote confirming that Donald had the feet skeletons of Foghorn Leghorn, Braunstein's daughter said her father received preferential treatment from his landlord. If there was anything wrong in the building, my dad would call and Trump would take care of it immediately. That was the small favour that he got. Seems that back in the day, being the godfather, who after all was a Sicilian, a tenement janitor and a cartoon road-eyed and red, was all part of a day's work for the apprentice liar-in-chief. I found this clip of Foghorn Leghorn, which is completely brilliantly apposite.
He's so dumb he thinks a Mexican border pays rent.
How about that?
Very good. Because he doesn't understand how to be a normal human, Trump shouldn't talk to children. On Christmas Eve, a 7-year-old kid called NORAD, the government organisation that helps kids track Santa when they're not detecting incoming missiles. As a fun publicity stunt, the kid was put through to the White House to talk to Trump, who proceeded to ask the kid if she still believed in Santa, following this up by saying, because at 7 it's kind of marginal, right? Look, you can put kids in cages, take healthcare away from millions of Americans and threaten nuclear-capable dictators with itchy trigger fingers, but never question a 7-year-old's belief in Santa.
In what must be the most perfectly executed backhanded insult, because you have the right to have a Secretary of Defense whose views are better aligned with yours, I believe it's right for me to step down from my position. Jim Mattis joined recent escaping adults John Kelly and Rex Tillerson in an exact reversal of the Christmas story. The three wise men have gazed upon the mewling, puking, swaddled Satsuma man baby, taken their gifts and hightailed it from the West Wing, in the sure and certain knowledge that no one will have any faith in it, even if it ever grows up.
So that's all the bad arguments and faulty reasoning we have time for this year. If you hear Trump say something stupid and wonder if it's a fallacy, find us on Twitter at @FallaciousTrump or email us on pod@fallaciousTrump.com.
If you think we've used a fallacy ourselves, let us know. And if you've had a good time, please give us a review on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can support the show on our Patreon page at patreon.com/ftrump.
You can connect with us and with other listeners in our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/fallaciousTrump, where we'll post some links to some of the stuff we've talked about.
All music is by The Outbursts and was used with permission. So until next time and next year on Fallacious Trump, we'll leave the last Christmassy word to the Donald.
That's right, go home to mommy. Bye. Bye!
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.